Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are live from the Kintec Studio 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. So six games remaining for the Canucks. Is that correct? Yes, I have that correct. Six games remaining for the Vancouver Canucks. You have declared it doesn't matter. Is there anything that could sway you there?
An injury. It matters that you stay healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. Like, so Rick Tockett.
Like, I get what you're saying. I 100% understand what you're saying.
Well, here's my question to you, because Rick Tockett, after like losses and stuff, is like, it's hard to flip the switch. It's hard to, you got to get ramping up now. And then he changes his lines again. And then he plays 11-7. And then he's like, Mark Friedman earned a game. And, you know, I kicked Brock Besser out of practice because he hadn't missed a practice in a while. Like, what he's saying and what he's doing are different things at this point.
Are they, though, or is he? Because I see what you're saying, right? That if he actually felt that sense of urgency, he'd be playing his best lineup consistently, right? He'd, you know, be keeping the lines together, giving them this runway. But it could be that. It could be what you're saying, or it could be he doesn't know what his best lineup is right now.
Well, I can't really tell, and I wish I was on the road trip so I could ask him. But it's like even the Pugh Suter thing, right? Like Pugh Suter gets a rest, and then he's like, you know, when you haven't scored in 30 games, and it's like, you know, I'm going to take a guy I need out of the lineup and try to reset him and try to make sure he's fresh, but also I'm going to throw some motivation into the room, and I'm certainly not going to publicly be like, oh boy, we're just counting the time.
See, I don't think Rick Tockett is like counting the time. I think he legitimately wants to see more urgency from his team.
Well,
I mean, he's been so honest with us, right?
I know. Well, he has been, but his tone's been a little different as the season's wound down.
That's true.
You know, like think about it this way, like if you're a player, you know, and it's like get the kids to the dentist's appointments, you know, like, you know, once the playoffs start, it's all playoffs.
Yep.
And this, like, stretch...
You're trying to, like, tie off all your loose ends.
Correct.
I'm doing that. You know, like, I'm like, 100%, hey, any social commitments we want to have, let's get them in the next 2 weeks here.
100%.
We need to have friends over, we got to do it now.
Oh, yeah. and so imagine what it's like if you're playing the games.
Yeah, seriously.
You know, like, this is a time of year where, again, you're in studying for exam mode. And the Saturday's game against the Kings, guess what? That ain't the exam.
Mm.
That's the test. That's the practice test that you printed off, you know, Shakespeare or whatever. Like, this is not what matters. So, yeah, I mean, it's just hard for me to get too worked up about it, especially now that the division's kind of sealed.
I think my concern probably stems a little bit from the fact that this season has been so surprising for the Canucks, right? So even though there's certain elements of their game that have been so impressive and have and continue to be really impressive, I think there's still a little bit of concern that, oh, is this them experiencing what you're describing, or is this coming back to earth in some way, right? Like, are these problems just a result of the lack of intensity of this time, or do they illustrate actually bigger flaws about the team? And I think
it depends.
That question's more relevant for a team having this kind of unexpected season like the Canucks.
Sure.
I think it is, than for your traditional perennial contender.
I think that's an interesting, and I think both things can be true.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's like, you know, if you're telling me that the Canucks have changed or are like materially different now than they were at the start of the year, I'd say you're right. They're better defensively.
Mm-hmm.
If you're saying that the Canucks are different in terms of how they're trying to attack, how they're trying to generate offense, like, your eyes are just lying to you. It's just that for 3 months of the season, the Canucks finished on 14% of their shots, and now they're finishing on 8, which, by the way, isn't even low. It's just normal, you know? And that's the difference. But, like, this team's always been dependent on deflections, right? They've always been...
Mm-hmm. That's always been a huge part of their game, yeah.
That's all their goals. I mean, this was evident. Like, the thing is it wasn't numbers that were telling me that I thought this team was subject to regression risk. It was the way they played. Mm. It was the way they attacked. There's always been a ton of point shots. 40%+ of their shot attempts, 5-on-5, have come from defensemen this season.
This question comes in, would the end of the season be more meaningful if the season was shorter, or would it just make the meaninglessness occur earlier? I think it would definitely prevent a little bit of it, right? Because part 100%. Of what we're talking about here is that the season is just such a marathon for these guys, right?
Absolutely.
Like, it's a slog. Even for good teams, for bad teams, I mean, we've all seen how much of a slog it is for the bad teams at this point of the year. Now we're seeing how much it can be for the good teams. So you're always going to have this kind of period of, you know, the calm before the storm, before the playoffs. But I do think if you reduced the toll, the mental, physical toll, how condensed the schedule is on the players, and I understand why this is never going to happen, because the NHL likes making money and they make more of it with an 82-game schedule, but I do think it would reduce this kind of sense of spinning our wheels, just waiting to get to the good stuff here at the end.
Yeah, well, the league remains gate-driven. You know, you got to maximize the amount of...
Gates.
Yep. Yeah. But, you know, I guess the argument would be, is the NHL... by having such a watered-down regular season product to the point where we can kind of
preventing the growth
of the television product, which then prevents your growth of revenue streams in terms of the value of rights and sponsorship and on and on. You know, that would be... But that's a long-sighted argument, so I don't expect that would carry any traction with anybody.
That would never fly in the NHL. What?
Games mattering? Oh, and look, honestly, I think the NBA is bumping up against this too, where like... You get to this point in the season, and the lineups are wild. Mm-hmm. It's like Malachi Flynn 50-point game. Like
legendary.
Like, I don't know if you've seen some of these Raptors lineups that they've been trotting out the last couple weeks, but it's like, who? Who's Liberty Freeman? Do you know that this guy's starting for the Raptors?
Liberty
last 2 weeks?
Freeman? That sounds like a 100% made-up name.
It's a hyphenated last name.
Liberty Freeman.
Of a Raptors starter. Do you not? Really?
No, I don't watch the Raptors.
Yeah, man. Javon Freeman Liberty.
Freeman Liberty. Okay. That's an incredible name.
You know what?
It really is. It's like it means the same thing twice.
Yeah, but it's cool.
It is. No, I'm not saying it's wrong. It's great.
Anyway, the other thing I think you could do to manufacture some intensity at this time of year would be adopt the NHL schedule standing system, because it's not about the ninth and tenth team being play-in teams, quote unquote. It's that you create different cliffs in the schedule, mm-hmm. right? Like there's a cliff between the second team and the third team, right? A meaningful one, because you've got the ability to play a more tired opponent versus a more rested opponent. There's a cliff between 4 and 5 because there's home ice, right? Cliff between 6 and 7, a significant one, because that's a pure playoff team versus a play-in team.
Yeah.
And then you've got that other cliff between 9 and 8. Right? Because then you can make the playoffs with 83 games mm-hmm. versus 84. And then obviously the big one between 10 and 11. Like, to me, that's the sort of thing where you could create meaning at this stretch of the season, especially because the battle for like sixth in the Pacific, Vegas at 92 points, Nashville at 92 points, LA at 891 points, like that would be a dogfight to avoid the play-in game. Can you imagine?
Oh, 100%.
Can you imagine the intensity of Vancouver's next two games? It would be like, man, then we'd be talking about how these games matter. You know, you're getting LA and Vegas' best, and you have a chance to like make them work hard.
You have
to end
play spoiler. Plus, you just like to for you to raise your intensity, you need an opponent who's playing for something, right? It's really hard to do to just unilaterally be the super, super intense team when the other team doesn't really care about a game.
Not to mention that the Canucks being tied with the Avalanche and holding the tiebreaker would be the difference between playing the first play-in team versus being locked into the winner of the Vegas, Nashville, LA.
Mm.
So it's like if you finish ahead of Colorado, then you get to play the team that finishes
like St. Louis, Calgary, Minnesota, or something, right?
No,
like we're talking about here.
That's who.
Okay.
Dallas
would
get.
Right. That's who Dallas.
But you'd
okay.
get you'd get like the winner of the Nashville, LA play-in,
right? Instead of the team that makes the
yeah. So I mean, you could still end up with Vegas, but like you'd still be dealing with the same three teams, but you'd have that team having had to play an extra game.
But I will say, even like the conference, the only thing the conference matters for right now, depending on how you feel about Nashville, I guess, as a playoff opponent versus LA and Vegas, is potential home ice in like the conference finals. Whereas in this system,
Yeah, there's you're talking relevant.
Like you'd be like, oh man, go win the conference. You're getting a huge drop in the quality of the team if you go do that.
And I mean, Vancouver's 3 points back of the Stars with six games to go. That's like tough. But could you imagine the intensity of the Stars Canucks game from a couple weeks ago? If it was like, hey, you win, you've got a shot at maybe facing the Blues or the Wild in the first round.
Yeah,
no, not a guarantee. You might still face LA or Nashville, but it's a different set of dynamics there. So again. Just another reason why I'm a big fan of team play, and it just creates different incentives that last more continuously throughout the campaign.
This texture makes a good point because, you know, obviously we're talking about shortening the schedule and why it would never happen because of the revenue implications for the NHL. This texture says, what would revenues look like with a shorter regular season and an expanded playoff field? And certainly like a play-in tournament would be one way if you did want to slightly turn down the number of games, like even to like 74 or something like that, right? An expanded playoff field, a play-in tournament would be one way to kind of offset those revenues a little
bit. Yeah, but I mean, do both. If you're going to keep 82 and we know it's too long, just do both, you know? That's my view of it. Anyway.
I guess. But doesn't sound like either one's happening at any rate.
No, for sure. Well, and I also don't think.
Because it's the NHL.
They're never going to shorten the season.
This text comes in. If it doesn't matter right now, would you be okay with scratching Elias Pettersson to get him healthy since everyone thinks he is hurt? Does everyone think Elias Pettersson is hurt? I mean,
well,
he had
the maintenance day.
But so did Brock Besser, kind of.
Yeah, Besser got like kicked off the ice.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Which was a little odd. But it can't be too serious because then they would just sit him for a game or two, wouldn't they? Like, that's what they're doing with Elias Lindholm, we think, though we don't have exact certainty there. It's really hard for me to imagine that, especially in against the Ducks, against the Coyotes, that if there was anything beyond just like bumps and bruises going on with Pettersson, that he wouldn't be out of the lineup at this point of the season when it's so clearly about the playoffs. I'm all for taking him out of the lineup if you think that would help, if you think that gets him on the right track, if that puts him in the best position to succeed for the playoffs, then by all means, like, use this time that you've bought yourself with a really strong season to rest your guys. I just have to think that if that was the case, if that was something that would have helped, I feel like we might have seen it already by now.
Yeah, you'd hope. You'd hope. I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, I suspect if this was something where rest Pettersson and you'll get 90% better Pettersson, that he'd be being rested for sure.
That's the thing, right? Like, it can't be that.
No.
So I get why people are speculating about injuries or whatever, but it just seems like, why on earth would he be in the lineup at this point if it was actually injuries that they were worried about? I am curious to see, you know, especially with the division race looking pretty locked up here. And, you know, if we'll see what the result is tomorrow, but they could really lock it up here in short order. I'm curious to see, as you said, like game 82 might be like a 10-minute game for Quinn Hughes. I'm curious to see if anything goes beyond that, if they do take guys out of the lineup for a game, if, you know, if it's a rotation, Pettersson, Miller, Hughes, Kronik has played so many minutes this year. Do you get these guys a chance to rest a little bit down the stretch? But then you also think these guys are pushing for milestones, a lot of them, right?
Like, yeah,
certainly
yeah.
Philip Kronik. Totally. He wants 50 points.
Brock Besser wants 40 goals.
Brock Besser wants 40 goals.
Quinn Hughes has a Norris to wrap up.
Yep. And he wants 90 points.
20 goals.
Yeah.
I know that requires three goals or four goals in six games, but the way professional athletes are wired, right? Remember, they're all Han Solo. Don't tell me the odds. Never tell me the odds. Right? Yeah, I mean, look, well, I guess the one thing that I'd say is making sure that you win at least one and ideally two of the Kings, Golden Knights, Oilers game. I think psychologically it would help. I do think dropping two of three or...
It's not ideal.
I do think there's something about like, well, it's been a while since we've beat a good team. I don't... You want to find the like 85% that works. And right now, this Canucks team's 85% like has left them outclassed by the Stars, losing to the Kings. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I do think you want to have, You want to have a consequential win here
against a good team. Go check some boxes, as you said.
Yeah,
Get Brock Besser's 40 goals. Get Quinn Hughes the Norris. Make sure he has a big night.
And stay healthy above all else.
Stay healthy. Get Philip Ronick to 50 points.
Get Demko just a couple games of reps.
Go take care of business in these final games and just get yourself feeling as good. Get the vibes as good as possible going in to your first round playoff series.
Although I'm telling you, I really don't believe, I don't believe that the Canucks could go out and lose to the Kings on tomorrow, to the Golden Knights on Monday, and to the Oilers next Saturday, and then come out flying in game one of the playoffs. And we'd be like, yeah, right, of course. That didn't matter. And then they could, still lose the series in five, like the Winnipeg Jets did to the... Because that's the other thing to remember, right? Mm-hmm. Don't take game one of a series as a referendum on that series. A useful reminder.
Mm-hmm. I have no idea why you're pointing at me on that one.
Because you loved the Jets after game one. You're like, man, they got it.
I know why you're pointing at me. I'm joking. Yeah.
You.
I know. I goofed. I blew it. The first man to ever get a series wrong in the NHL playoffs. It finally happened.
I'm the only guy who's ever overreacted to a thing. Sorry. I didn't mean to
No, I don't care.
I was just reminding us. I didn't think of it as accusing you. Does that make sense?
Yes.
All right. I feel bad now. I'm sorry.
I don't care at all. Are you kidding?
Jets lover over here.
Yeah. Oh, Jamie and his Jets.
Jamie and his love of cities without airports.
Classic. all right. Speaking of playoff hockey, you can watch some in the Lower Mainland tonight. The Vancouver Giants, big game 4 at the Langley Event Center tonight in their first round series against the Everett Silvertips. Everett up 2-1. Remember, the Giants won the first game in that series, so they need a win on home ice to even that series up, heading back to Everett. 7 o'clock tonight at the Langley Event Center. Tickets still available. Should be a good one, so go check it out if you can. For more on the Giants, here's the Giants report with play-by-play voice Nathan Canter.
It was a tough loss on Wednesday night in Game 3 of the Vancouver Giants opening round best-of-seven series against the Everett Silvertips, falling 3-1, a game where Everett struck twice on the power play, including on a controversial goal that actually held up as the game winner. Video and skill development coach Caden Jarvis says the message to the team ahead of Game 4 is all about belief, given that all three games so far in the series have been incredibly close.
It's not like we're getting blown out of the water. It's not like we're not competing in these games. We're right there, and we're pushing the pace at points. So I think just making sure the guys realize that we belong in this series, and we have what it takes to get to the next level here. And I think it's just that, just the belief in the guys.
In other Giants news, the Western Hockey League announced on Thursday that Giants netminder Brett Merwald has been named the BC Division Goaltender of the Year, and with it, a finalist for the Del Wilson Memorial Trophy, presented annually to WHL's top goaltender. Giants forward Tyson Zimmer chimed in on why he thinks Merwald should win WHL's Goaltender of the Year award.
I mean, he's unbelievable. It's pretty well said. I mean, the second game, he had 50 saves or whatever it was. I don't know. And I mean, even when I wasn't on the team, you see it every night, every week. It's just a 40-save shutout. It's a 50-save shutout. It's one goal, 50 saves. It's just he's really good. I mean, takes everything serious, and it shows in games. We have a chance to win every single night. If we score one goal, we have a chance to win. I mean, he's just there every step of the way, and he helps us.
We'll have to wait a little bit to see if he does win Goaltender of the Year, as the WHL Awards will be announced publicly from Tuesday, April 30th until Thursday, May 9th. And as he has done all season long, the Giants will certainly need Merwald yet again tonight. A 7 o'clock puck drop for Game 4, with the Giants trailing the Everett Silvertips 2-1 in the best-of-seven series. Come on down to the LEC by grabbing your tickets at vancouvergiants.com/tickets or call 604-4GIANTS to hear about some deals for tonight's game. It's the most important game of the season for sure. Either the Giants tie the series 2-2, heading back to Everett on Sunday for Game 5, or they're trailing 3-1. If they do tie it 2-2, it will guarantee a Game 6 at the Langley Event Center on Tuesday, April 9th. For your Giants report, I'm Nathan Cantor.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We are now very pleased to be joined by the play-by-play voice of the Vancouver Canucks here on Sportsnet 650, our guy Brendan Batchelor. Batch, what's going on, man?
What's up, brothers? How's it going?
Not too much. All right, so on a scale of 1 to 10, six games remaining in the regular season for the Vancouver Canucks, how much do these six games matter?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I mean, they matter as much as they haven't locked up the division yet, so that matters. You know, they've got some games against tough teams above the playoff bar, so that matters. But in terms of, you know, will I be, you know, holding their ultimate playoff fate in the hands of how they do in these six games, I'm not entirely sure, because I think we've seen in past years that sometimes rolling going into the playoffs is important and matters, and I think that was the case with Vegas last year. But the year the Colorado Avalanche won their Stanley Cup, I think they really struggled down the stretch and then were able to find that extra gear in the postseason. So yeah, they matter. I don't know, out of 10, like 7 maybe in terms of importance, but that's mostly being placed on the fact that you know, they need to lock up the division, and a few wins gets that done for them. And then the sooner they can lock up the division, the earlier they can rest players. If there isn't a ton of spotlight on that game against Edmonton next Saturday, that would be preferable for them, so that, you know, it's not a high-pressure game where they've got to put all their guys in the lineup and be super worried about it. But then on the other side of the coin, maybe a high-pressure playoff-like game is exactly what this team would need to get ready for the postseason too. So we'll see how it plays out.
What's your view on, like, the Canucks play the Kings and the Golden Knights here, and then they've got that game 80 against the Oilers, which might matter. With regards to this team's sort of struggles against playoff teams the last couple weeks, is there a number of games you want to see them win from those sort of three remaining against Western Conference playoff teams? I'm not counting the Jets in game 82, because I assume that's a gentleman's agreement. Like, hey, everybody, let's just make sure no one's hurt for the playoffs.
Well, and I'm sure that things will be locked up by then too. If they're not, that's a problem. I don't know. I mean, obviously I'd like to see them win all three. I think if you have a winning record in those three games, you can feel good about it. Another factor in this conversation is going to be how many of those three games is Thatcher Demko able to play. It doesn't seem like he'll be able to play the one tomorrow against LA based on the stuff coming out of Canucks practice today. I don't know if it's too early to expect him to be able to go Monday against Vegas. It might make more sense to get him back in a softer matchup, shall we say, against Arizona on Wednesday, and then have 2 days between games before the Oilers on Saturday. So, you know, yeah, you'd like to win two of three for sure, I think. But at the same time, as I was saying before, like the sky isn't falling if they don't, because they don't have their starting goaltender right now. And I think that's a big factor, because, you know, as much as I think this team has sort of been up and down a little bit, and I'm not going to sit here and hang anything on Casey DeSmith, but the last time they beat a team that was above the playoff bar was the last game that Thatcher Demko was in the net in against Winnipeg back in early March. And, you know, I don't think that's a coincidence. I think it's a team that plays better and plays more confidently when they've got him behind them. And that's going to be the most important factor probably of the final six games here in the next couple of weeks, is how soon does Demko get back? How does he look? How does he feel? How many games can he get into? And how confident are you in his abilities when the playoffs start in two weekends from now?
That's an interesting point about beating teams above the playoff bar and how they haven't been able to do so since Thatcher Demko is out. Now, I do think going into tomorrow, the goaltending is a bit of an interesting talking point. Artur Seelovs obviously has picked up the team's last two wins, albeit against the Coyotes and the Ducks, but he's looked really good. Do you think there's an argument to be made for giving him the start against the LA Kings tomorrow night?
Not a good one, but I've heard the argument made here in the last couple of days. You know, he's a very young goaltender who, you know, is still growing and developing. Yes, he's had two good games, but they're, let's be honest, against two of the bottom feeders in this league. you know, I don't know how much better he would have fared than Casey DeSmith in the Vegas game if he would have fared better. So, you know, to put him in a game like that over Casey DeSmith, who will be rested, who will not played since Tuesday, I think it's sort of, there's, the risk is much greater than the reward in that, you know, Shelov has played a couple games here. He's got some confidence. You don't want to ruin that by putting him in against a playoff team and potentially having it go poorly. You also need to reestablish Casey DeSmith's confidence after a tough outing against the Golden Knights, because I think some of the narrative in this market is kind of switched to, oh, DeSmith hasn't been very good. But prior to that Vegas game, he had been giving them a chance to win most of the games since Demko's been out. And, you know, you look at the games since Demko's been out, other than that Vegas game, they haven't lost by more than a couple of goals. And the only game that, you know, as I look back here at the schedule, the only game that they've lost by more than two goals other than the Vegas game was the Dallas game, which I believe, did that have an empty netter at the end of it? I think it did. Yeah, it did. Jason Robertson scored an empty netter. So, like, Casey DeSmith has allowed the Canucks to be in one-goal games, essentially, when they're not winning, which means they are getting a chance to win every time he goes between the pipes. And, you know, in a worst-case scenario where Thatcher Demko gets hurt again or can't come back and you actually need to roll with Casey DeSmith in important games in the final six or potentially in the playoffs, you need to have that guy confident. You need to have him playing well, feeling well. So, you know, I can understand, and I think it's, this market always has a penchant for, you know, wanting to rush along younger players or being excited about younger players. And I'm not saying don't be excited about Artur Shelov and the way that he's played. I just think that would be a bridge too far to put him in tomorrow night.
Are you at all moved by the idea of sort of giving Shelov a chance to just like see him against other good teams, given that DeSmith's expiring and you might want to have as much information as possible going into the offseason?
I would be here for that conversation if this injury had happened earlier in the year. But we just finished talking about how important these last six games are, and especially the three against playoff teams, excluding the Winnipeg game at the end of the year. So to me, no, because it's now more important to get a gauge of what you can expect for your from your team in those kind of games than it is looking at the long-term future of a very young goaltender who's going to be in your organization either way. So, you know, what I would do if it were possible with the cap is say, you know, if that Edmonton game next Saturday doesn't mean anything, if you've locked up the division by then and Demko's back, then hey, recall Artur Shelov, try and make it work under the cap, put him in that game if you really feel like you need to get a gauge of how he can perform against better opposition. But, you know, now you have to sort of look short term rather than long term. So, you know, if we're talking about this a month ago, then sure, give him a game against the playoff team and see how he does. But now that we're right down to the end of the season, I still wouldn't do it.
So obviously a lot of conversation in this market right now about Elias Pettersson, and over the last month or so especially, and even Jim Rutherford weighs in yesterday talking to our colleague Ian McIntyre, saying, you know, obviously he hasn't been himself, but that Rutherford is not worried about Pettersson at all in the long term or even in the short term. When you're watching Elias Pettersson these days, what stands out the most to you, Batch?
A lack of assertiveness, I think I would say. Like, when Pettersson is at his best, he controls the game at times, right? And Rick Tocchet always talks about wanting guys that demand the puck. That, to me, when Pettersson is playing his game, he demands the puck. He has the puck on his stick. He's diligent. He's assertive. He's making things happen. And it's been a little too tentative and not assertive enough from him lately, to the point where, you know, even on the power play, there have been plays that have been dying on his stick in the offensive zone that allow other teams to get clearances. Maybe not so much the past few games, because the power play has been a little bit better here over the last three, I believe it is, they've scored in three games in a row now. So, you know, maybe that's not quite as applicable as it was a week ago, say. But, you know, when Pettersson is peak Elias Pettersson, not that he's the same player as JT Miller, but he has that assertiveness. He has that, you know, willingness to take the puck to the net, to make a play, and has that confidence with the puck that I don't think is there for him right now. And I think we've seen flashes of it. Like, there was a goal that Höglander scored at some point in the last few games where Pettersson got hit at center and he didn't like it, and he got in on the forecheck and helped them dig the puck loose, and Höglander jammed it home at the top of the crease. And you could see a little bit of that you know, for lack of a better term, FU in Pettersson's game. When Pettersson has that, that's what makes him a good player, and that's what he's been missing of late in my mind.
Are the Canucks taking too many point shots?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that at a time of the year where it's harder to get to the middle of the ice, some of that down-low offense that they've been generating just isn't there. And that might be because teams are game-planning against them to take those options away from them, or it's just, you know, they can't get to those areas with the amount of regularity that they did early in the year. So when you don't have a look down low, what's the easy play? Send it high, get a shot on net, traffic and bodies to the goal. But at the same time, that can't be your only way to generate offense. And it does kind of remind me, and not to draw direct parallel between this, because I think they were two very different teams and two very different eras in this organization, but that's a lot of the offense we saw the Canucks try to generate in the final days of Travis Green's tenure here, where they had, coming into that year, there had been a focus on defense, on being better in their own zone, and they were better in their own zone, but their offense dried up. And, you know, we saw a lot of low to high shot, but maybe not enough traffic, not able to generate a rebound, and teams would get the puck and exit the zone, and there would be a lot of one-and-done plays. So I see some parallels there, although I think this team is more dynamic and more capable of generating offense off those sorts of plays. And, hey, when you got Quinn Hughes scoring like he has been lately and scoring on some long-range shots, then you're not necessarily going to complain about it. But I do wonder if it's a byproduct of the fact that teams are taking away some of the looks that they've had for most of the year, and now it'll be up to them to find new ways to create in other ways than just low to high plays and shots to the net.
It's an interesting comparison there, Batch, because the other thing I remember about the last days of Travis Green was Pettersson struggling immensely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, that was Pettersson's really big struggle, wasn't it? Like Bruce Boudreau came in and kind of breathed new life into his game. So, I don't know if that's a direct parallel you can draw, but, there's offensively, they've got to find a way, as Tocchet keeps saying, to get inside and to, you know, make it harder on opponents in terms of the offense they create, the places they're getting shots from, the traffic they create, scoring goals off broken plays rather than set plays, which Tocchet has talked about on the power play, but I think you can probably apply it to even strength as well. And, you know, when you look at Pettersson, all of that stuff applies to him as well. Like when I talk about him needing to be more assertive, he's got to get to those areas to allow him to produce offense, and we just haven't seen enough of that lately.
It's an interesting comparison to the end of the Travis Green era. And, you know, I think the biggest difference is that as much as their defense did improve slightly in that time under Travis Green, it's been not just good, it's been excellent under Rick Tocchet. So at least they've kind of found that. But I'm still kind of left with a similar question, which is, okay, can they kind of do both at a really high level at the same time? And, you know, I do wonder how much of it is it's this time of year, right? And so maybe there's not the impetus to be a little bit more aggressive. Do you feel like this team can kind of turn the dial slightly to more offensive generation, more creativity, without sacrificing too much on the back end?
Yeah, I mean, I would quibble a little bit with your point that they can't do it in terms of both, because they're top six in both goals for per game and fewest goals against per game in the league right now. So for most of this year, they have done it. They have been a top offensive team and a top defensive team. But I do agree that it's probably a byproduct of the time of year, of the way the game changes. Now, you know, I think another thing here, and Tocchet has talked about, you know, you want to be playing the way that you want to play going into the playoffs, and you can't just turn a switch for game one. And while I think there is certainly a large element of truth to that, there is a level of desperation and a level of intensity that these guys will reach when you get to the playoffs that you cannot manufacture when you're in this situation as a team where, you know, yeah, you'd like to have that level of intensity tomorrow night against the Kings, but guess what? It's not a huge game one in a series. And, you know, to a certain extent, guys are playing through bumps and bruises. You need to manage yourself so that you're not hurt or unable to contribute going to the playoffs. So I'm sure these are all factors that are playing into things right now. But all of this to say, I do think there's another level they can reach offensively while still being a strong defensive team, because I think we've seen that from them for large portions of this season. And yes, the game changes at this time of the year. But, you know, I think there are players on this roster that will be able to rise to that occasion and score some big time goals for this team. And I would also say that if you gave me the choice of being an elite defensive team or an elite offensive team going into the playoffs, I would take elite defensive team 10 times out of 10 and then just, you know, figure out where you can get some goals or how you can generate more offense, as long as, you know, you're not bleeding goals and you don't need four or five a game to win a playoff game. Then, you know, the pressure is somewhat lessened on the offense if you can win games 3-2 or 2-1 and you're not asking a lot of those top end guys. And in terms of the offensive production, I think the focus is going to become more and more on the power play, because this is a team that has generated all year at 5-on-5. They're one of the top offensive teams at 5-on-5 this year. And generally speaking, even through their struggles or their tough moments in the year, which have been few or far between, they've still been a team that drives play at 5-on-5, and maybe they've had bounces go against them, or their offense has dried up a little bit, or they had some unlucky pucks go in their net. But the fact that they are such a good 5-on-5 team means that at the very least in the playoffs, even strength should be a saw off. And then the focus will be on special teams and on those top players to produce on the power play to make the difference in some of those games, I think.
Batch, they have been a top offense all season, but I mean, we're talking about a team with 53 5-on-5 goals in their last 28 games. That ranks 25th. They're 27th in total goals for since the All-Star break. That's now a 28-game sample.
Yeah.
Are they a top offensive team? Like, can we look at the work over the balance of the season and say this is a top offensive team? Or how do we wait? Like, how do we wait how dramatic that fall-off has been and how sustained their struggle to score has been versus the overall track record?
I would say they can be a top offensive team, although, you know, shooting percentage is going to come into this, and obviously it was elevated early in the year. And
well, it's still historic. They're going to end the year with the highest shooting percentage we've ever seen.
Yeah, but it's been, like, it was north of 12% before the All-Star break, and I think it's been under 10% since the All-Star break, if I'm not mistaken, so or at least in that kind of conversation. So I think they can be a top offensive team. But this is going to be the challenge for them now, is, like we talked about, finding different ways to score and finding ways to score at this time of the year where teams defend much harder and you have to pay a price to get to the areas that you need to score. And, you know, like Rick Tocchet said at some point in the last week, he said, you need ice bags after the game if you want to score. Like, you got to be black and blue and willing to sacrifice to go to those areas. And this, to me, is all part of the conversation of a team that is light on playoff experience and certainly light on stretch run experience, because even when they made the bubble playoffs in 2020, there was no stretch run because of the pandemic. Understanding how the game changes at this time of year when things matter and when you're a top team and when teams are going to come in and give you their A game, as opposed to, you know, you're a club that's not in the playoffs that, you know, is just trying to play spoiler and get to the end of the season. You know, this is a learning experience for this group. And we do still have to remember, as much as they've been a very good team this year and as much as hopes are high and people want them to go on a long playoff run, this is really just the first time that they're back in the playoffs. So there is going to be a lot of learning that's going to take place here. And, you know, whether they succeed or fail remains to be seen, but the game changes now. And what can you do to elevate your game? What can you do to make a big time play for your team? What can you do to get the big goal when you need it? These are going to be the questions that are asked of each and every player in that dressing room. And we're going to learn a lot about this team and its makeup and maybe now how it needs to be tweaked or complemented going forward to try and have more success in the years to come, based on how much success or lack of success they have in terms of generating that offense and finding a more sustainable way to generate offense rather than having a historically high shooting percentage.
Batch, we know you're going to elevate your game come playoff time. So thanks for doing this as always, man.
Absolutely. I can't promise anything the next six games, but game one of the playoffs,
hey,
I'm flipping a switch, man.
I was going to say, rest up, all right? Take it easy. Don't injure yourself. Make sure the voice is in perfect condition, and then flip that switch come playoff time.
Sounds good. Thanks, boys.
All right, that is Brendan Batchelor, voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650.
Are you a big switch flipper yourself?
In like what context?
I don't know. What context do we ever mean it?
I don't know. Well, in going into the NHL playoffs, in that one, no, I'm not.
Well, there's like 10 phrases that we use in no other walk of life except talking That's about true. Sports and flip
I
the
will
switch.
Say, I so I will say in school, I was a big procrastinator.
Yeah.
Like, big, big procrastinator.
Okay. And can you flip the switch?
I mean, I'm here, aren't I? I don't know. It's worked out so far. Oh. My life hasn't gotten. No,
I thought you were saying that was
like
the reason.
I got my degree. Got a law degree.
Yeah, that's cool.
I got through.
Fair enough.
So it worked out in the end.
You got through to grade 20.
Yeah. Oh boy. Ugh.
Well, you did.
I did. That's
ever,
true.
You never thought about your life in those terms?
No, not really.
It's grim.
Yeah, it is very, very grim. So I would say I have a little bit of flip switching in me.
Switch
is that
flipping.
Right? Switch flipping.
I believe it's flip switching would be.
You flip the switch. Yes, yeah, switch flipping.
I don't know. I'm an always on the go guy. I'm a sustained pressure guy.
Mm.
You know?
No, I like to coast when I can. Find those moments where you can take your foot off the gas.
I'm an extremist is really what it comes down to. Like I'm like either all mm-hmm. work or all nothing. And I find it hard. Mm. And I actually find it very difficult to change modes. Like my first few days of vacation, I'm like checking Twitter.
I don't have that problem.
I'm like brainstorming. And then likewise, when I get back, like I had this week, I wrote a notebook on Tuesday night and it took me like 4 hours. And the words like were only okay. And then the next night, it took me 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was no problem at all because I'd like exercise the muscle.
I would say maybe coming back from vacation, I have like a little bit of an adjustment period, right? Where it's like, I open up the rundown. I'm like, what am I doing again? All right, this.
Yeah.
But it's like maybe one day.
Yeah, no, I can't personally flip the switch, but I've never met an NHL player who struggled with it.
Apparently, flip the switch is a military term.
Really?
Flip this, according to this texter, regular texter, says flip off the safety and start to fight. Flip the switch.
I'm pretty sure it refers to turning an electric circuit on and off, like a light.
Could definitely be correct.
Yeah.
We'll never know. There's no way to ever find out. If only there was some way we could look this up.
If only we had the internet.
I did think that was an astute and interesting point by Badge about the similarities between the final days of the Travis Green era and some of what we're seeing from the Canucks right now. Although it does come with a major, major caveat that like their defensive game is so, so high above what they were achieving at that point. So it's a trade-off that's a lot more easy to stomach when you're at least getting elite results on one side of the puck right now. But interesting point brought up by Batch.
Just received a text from Ian McIntyre in California. So just before we go to break, Thatcher went on after practice. Thatcher Demko was on after practice with Ian Clark per Ian McIntyre. Via his text to me. And here's what's interesting. Elias Lindholm skated with the group.
Ooh.
But was not on a set line, rotated through a couple of lines. So Lindholm is an extra at practice per McIntyre. He didn't see any other noticeable changes
in
the top nine.
What service from Ian McIntyre directly to the hosts on the air here on Sportsnet 650? That's incredible.
Quadruple threat.
Shout out to iMac. That's good. All right. I have a family matter to attend to called picking up my kid from school because I didn't realize the show was going until 3 o'clock today.
Wow.
So I'm going to get out of here. Drance. You're my co-host, right?
I'm Thomas.
Batch. Yeah, you're Thomas Drance. That's
Thomas
right.
Thomas Batch.
Canucks insider Thomas Drance.
We're both bald.
That's right. Drance and Dim will have you covered for the final segment. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the game. Tomorrow, we'll be back on Monday right here on Sportsnet 650.
And we're back. It's the final segment of Canucks Talk. Jamie has departed. I'm your host, Thomas Drance, joined by Dmitry Filipovich for one final segment this week before we formally welcome Dmitry to the program. 650 can be reached by you, our dear listeners, on the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver. You can visit them online as well at DunbarLumber.com. Dimitri, we did a PDO cast earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You're coming in to pinch hit. Yep. We usually do the look ahead at teams, and let's do that, actually, because Vancouver has some interesting... Well, I thought I was going to squirrel it, and then I was like, you know, I kind of want to talk about the Kings and the Golden Knights.
Sure.
So the LA Kings have come under fire for their 1-3-1.
Mm-hmm.
And it's widely considered to be an affront to the sport itself.
Right.
You hate dull hockey more than anyone I know.
Who likes it? Maybe, I guess, the Kings?
Me.
Jim Heller?
I'm okay with dull hockey.
Right.
I certainly don't think it's like a moral... I have no moral problem with the way the Kings play. If it works, it works.
Well, do you think it's the best strategy for them, though? Because I think they have the personnel to play a different style and have success.
Like, I do, too.
Sometimes teams kind of purposefully, out of necessity, like, dull the game down and grind it down because they know they're in a talent deficit, and if they play a regular game against more talented teams, they'll lose, and that'll get exposed. I don't think this Kings team fits that, and I think that's what makes it kind of disappointing. I'm not acting as if it's, like, a moral affront to hockey and I'm personally offended by it, but I do think they could be more fun than they are right now.
I can see it. I can see what you're saying. The fact sort of remains, though, they've been a 625 point percentage team, 35 points in 28 games with Jim Hiller. Everything about their profile has been, well, I guess their control of play hasn't been as good since the coaching change.
They've been cleaning up against inferior competition recently, too.
Yeah, certainly their results have been a little bit better. I don't know. I think they do it well, and I think they've got a mature enough team to do it well, and they've got some guys who can counterpunch against it. I think they play it well.
They do. They do. I just think that I was really hopeful heading into the season that they had made the necessary moves to take that next step.
To play some East-West, like,
fun hockey. And to really, like... I mean, they'd exchange punches with the Oilers the past couple of years, but ultimately fell short because they just didn't have...
And they kind of felt like the foil in that series. Like, they were just good enough to annoy the Oilers. Like,
to
put the Oilers to the brink, but you knew they weren't going to win the series.
Yeah, the Oilers needed their superhero moment to,
exactly,
to finish it off and get over the hump, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It is a bit disappointing. Certainly with players like Fiala and Kempe, like, they're, like, two of my favorite guys in terms of, like, just the flair they have and the skill, and they don't necessarily get to utilize it because of the way they play. Now, in the postseason, particularly against a team like the Canucks, we've seen the past couple times they've played, like, it can be very irritating, and if they get the requisite goaltending, it could ultimately lead to a series victory, and that would be viewed as, like, a positive development for them based on the past couple years.
So... The Canucks have scored so often first, but against the Kings, all three games, the Kings have scored first, allowing them to kind of dictate pace. There's a sense, I feel like, in this market that the Kings, like, have the Canucks number, but I actually think the Canucks, because they have Tockett, who's a sharp X's and O's coach, and because they have JT Miller, who's, like, watching more game tape than just about any non-goalie in the league, I actually think the Canucks are relatively well-suited to figuring out some strategies to bust the 1-3-1, and that the three games we've seen head-to-head between these two teams aren't necessarily representative for some of the same reasons that I think Vancouver's, like, overall record and offensive track record isn't necessarily representative of who they are because of how frequently they've opened the scoring in the first 5 minutes. I almost feel like there's an opposite distributional edge that applies solely to the Canucks and Kings head-to-head. How would you handicap the Kings as a first-round opponent for Vancouver?
Well, to be clear, like, it's gotten a lot of attention recently for some reason, but this isn't anything new for the Kings, right? Like,
no.
They've been employing this neutral zone trap for a while now.
Yep.
And the workaround for the Oilers the past couple of years was give the puck to Connor McDavid, and he'll skate around them, and he'll get the puck to where it needs to be. And the Canucks don't have a Connor McDavid, but they do have Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson, who are two really good puck transporters, right? And so I think in that sense, there should be enough ways there that they can kind of navigate it. So I do think it's, all things being equal, not the worst matchup for the Canucks. Like, it can be a frustrating one, and I think some of the games might be, like, very coin flippy, and that can be stressful for a number one seed. At the same time, though, you look at some of the other teams in the West, and all things being equal, I think the Canucks could do a lot worse than the Kings as a first round opponent.
So before we move on to the Golden Knights, and this, we'll use this as a transition to do so, rank in your mind Nashville, LA, Vegas, on the basis of which would present the largest threat to the Canucks in a hypothetical first round series.
It's got to be the Golden Knights based on what we've seen the past 10 or so games, right? Like, we've seen them sort of get back into that
peak transition form where they're just moving downhill, constantly attacking off the rush. I think the Predators are a very scary team because they play a very similar style to the Canucks from like a effort, intensity, activity perspective when they're at their best. So in that sense, with UC Saros in that as well, if they get out to some early leads, they can just lean on the puck in the offensive zone and just string together like extended shifts. And I don't know if the Canucks would love kind of working uphill in that sense against them. So I would go Golden Knights, Predators, and then Kings in that order. But between the Predators and the Kings, I think it's kind of...
flip a coin.
Yeah, it's subjective. I've been high on the Predators all season, so I got to stick with it.
The Canucks would be favored against, I think, all three teams once home ice advantage is factored in.
Right.
Right? I even think they'd be favored against the Knights, but probably narrowly. The Knights are considered to have better consensus Stanley Cup odds, about 12-1, whereas the Canucks are consensus sort of 14-1. So close enough that I think the fact that the Canucks would have the extra game in hand or an extra game at home would probably leave them favored, and I'm pretty confident they'd be favored against either Nashville or LA. With the way you look at it, would you be picking the Canucks against all three, two and one? I mean, how would you sort of break it down personally?
Yeah, it's tough. You and I talked about this on my show that you referenced earlier, kind of try to make sense of what we've seen from the Canucks recently and how much stock we should put into that, because this is a team that has been pretty comfortable in their position for a while now and isn't necessarily incentivized to like show us everything right now, right? Not that they're not trying their best, but I think like it could look a lot different.
Workable 85%
once the postseason starts, certainly. So in that sense, it's tough to know. It depends on the Golden Knights in terms of, I want to see more games from them right now, like to see if what they've shown us signs of, particularly the last time these two teams played, looked so different than their previous meeting. They've got one more coming up here. I want to see how that shakes out and then see what happens with Hurdle and Stone if those guys come back. I think I would pick the Golden Knights in that case. I would pick the Canucks against the other two, though, just because I think the talent gap at the high end there with the defensive system in place and the home ice, I would pick the Canucks, but they're all razor thin, and that's not something you want to hear, right? Because
the Canucks are
they've been
be the
so far ahead
seed,
of them all regular season, and the reward you get for that is a 51-49% probability or something like that. Like, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I was like, I think I'd pick Vancouver in 6 over Nashville and Vancouver in 7 over L.A., which, you know, for me, there's no gap between picking between 6 and 7, really. It's just like I'd pick the Canucks to win at home.
Right.
And then against the Kings, I just think it's going to be such a, I don't think home ice is going to matter at all. I literally think it's just the lottery balls of who scores first in every game. I think whoever scores first in every game is going to win maybe all but one.
Yeah. You have, the thing about the Kings though, right, is like whether it's Talbot or Rittich and that, like that's one legitimate advantage, assuming Demko comes back and is like in full peak form. Yeah,
but the Canucks have played Talbot twice and Rittich once, and they've scored three goals in three games outside of empty net and 3-on-4 in overtime. You know, it's like,
I thought the game they played in LA was pretty encouraging though. Like, I thought, especially as it went along, like I thought they were getting some looks. I thought the two games they played in Vancouver were pretty bleak,
game they played in LA was simply LA generated. Vancouver made two mistakes in that third period and gave up 2 2-on-1s. And
right, Trevor Lewis just missed the puck.
And there was another one that they failed to execute, and like seconds later Doughty hit the post.
True.
After the puck went back up high. To me, it was like LA got exactly what they wanted out of that game, and then they just missed their shot, and the fancy stats looked one way, but the actual game flow was completely in LA's favor, and they just missed their chances.
Yeah, you might be right. Might have to go rewatch that one. I just remember, I feel like the one in LA, like Pettersson scored a cool goal or something, right? And I remember thinking, like, there we go. Like, this is what separates these two teams.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's just in the back of my mind and kind of like overshadowed.
You were just rooting for
what was happening for the
other 59. Because you hate dull hockey.
Yeah, all three of those games have been just really tough to watch. And I know that's something that gets like lionized in the postseason, right? Like, if we get 7 games of that where it's like always within one goal and it's like tied in a third, it's gonna be a bunch of overtimes, people are gonna be like, wow, this is so tight.
But remember Kings Blues WrestleMania?
Yeah,
that first round series they, like, back when you were just allowed to like literally wrestle on the ice. Like, it was unwatchable hockey.
Yep.
The biggest dreck I've ever seen.
Was that 2012?
Yeah, something like that. It was like
it was after that.
Yeah, it was after that. But it was like the Bacchus Blues versus and it was just like, you've never seen referees eat so many whistles.
Yeah. Yeah, but that was every King series back then.
It was. It was
and,
bad.
And they won a lot of them, so.
Yeah, they did. Let's move on to Vegas. So we've already kind of talked about it. I mean, I kind of look at this. So they've got that top line flying now. They've got that Dorofiev, Carlson, Mantha line.
Dorofiev getting top billing here.
That line looks good.
Yeah, yeah.
Where would you put Tomáš Hertl if you were Bruce Cassidy on his return? I was thinking about this. Like, does he bump Paul Cotter back to the fourth line? Or do you load up like Dorofiev, Carlson, Hertl?
So we're gonna see Hertl shed the non-contact jersey and he's practicing in full, right?
We'll see him this week at some point. Just not clear when.
I think it makes sense to essentially have him playing in like the Mark Stone role, obviously as the center, but just like bump Chandler Stephenson to the wing, which is what they've done in the past, and kind of play off of his speed in that way. Because I think right now Stevenson's centering a line with Amadio and Cotter.
Yeah.
And like that's fine. But I think that's one area.
They play well.
I wouldn't mess with that top six, right? Like those two lines you referenced have been playing really well. So it would probably be that and sort of set up a potential line when Stone comes down the line down the road as well as like just a dominant possession line.
Like a Hertl, Chandler Stephenson, Stone.
Yeah.
Third line?
Yeah.
Nasty.
Not bad.
Yeah. Nasty.
Yeah.
Ugh. Nasty.
I mean, you'd probably slot them ahead of that Carlson line and then kind of use the Carl. I guess, yeah, I don't know. They have so many options there, right? That's kind of why I think everyone was so worried about it at the trade deadline when they got all these guys. I was like, oh my God, if everyone actually hits the ice at any point, it's going to be a nightmare.
Yeah, and I don't think we'll see him on Monday against the Canucks, but we might. But we might. Okay, more volatile team going into the playoffs, Vegas or Vancouver?
I guess it depends on your frame of reference there, right? Like, I think Vegas has certainly been very volatile this season, but we've seen them have immense success in the postseason with a particular style, and we've seen them get back to playing that way recently. Now, I guess you could say, okay, if Jack Eichel gets hurt or something, then all of a sudden that goes out the window, but that's true for pretty much every team, right? I think it's the Canucks one just because they're so reliant, as we saw in that last game against Vegas. Like, if they go down early, they're going to play right into Vegas's hands and open the game up, and that's when Vegas is at their best, and they'll punish you every time. So the Canucks would essentially have to throw all their eggs in the basket of scoring first. And no matter what you do, there's no guarantee that's going to happen. So as soon as they go down, I would be instantly worried that Vegas is going to score the next goal and blow the game wide open. So I guess in that sense, Vancouver's is more volatile because like their margin for error is so small.
Right. Yeah. And
what's your answer to that?
No, I think it's got to be Vancouver because I guess volatility kind of cuts both ways. I struggle because I see a wider downside case for Vancouver than for Vegas in the playoffs. I think even if Vegas like doesn't get Mark Stone back and just gets like, I think their mid-range outcome where that you don't get Mark Stone back for the first round, but you still get Tomáš Hertl and you have all this experience and all this size on the blue line and you don't get Aiden Hill back, but you've still got Logan Thompson. I mean, I think the downside case there is like a really tough fought 6-2 series loss, whereas for Vancouver, you know, you've got the Lindholm question, you've got the Demko question. Like, I think Vancouver's got a larger, you've had a 30 game stretch where this club has been inept offensively. To me, there's like a downside case where the Canucks really could fall flat. But on the other hand, I think there's an upside case for Vegas where they could be the best team, like the best true talent team on the ice in the NHL in the postseason, that I think expands beyond the Canucks. So it's like, I just feel it's difficult to price because one team's more volatile or has like a more compelling skinny part of the bell curve case on the right side and the other one has it to the left side.
Yeah, and Vegas, similar to the Canucks, like at their best, they have a very stingy defensive environment in terms of like giving you everything from the outside, but you just cannot get into the slot against them. But also that feeds into like their transition game, which is also an absolutely elite component, right? So they can kind of beat you in both ways in that sense. They're sort of like go hand in hand,
whereas Vancouver needs to soak up a lot of zone time so that they don't give up stuff against the grain.
Precisely. And my one concern about Vegas before the deadline was just the foot speed. It was like, I'm worried if a team just pressures them constantly whether they can keep up. A lot of that's been alleviated with Eichel coming back and looking healthy and just dominating again, and then adding Hanifin and adding Mantha, who even though he's big, is still, once he gets moving, very fast. And there's a lot of speed there.
Hanifin's given them way more push from the back end than they had without him.
Yeah, and now they're splitting up the defense pair, so they've got him
with Haig,
Petrangelo, or Theodore on the ice at all times. Yeah. So that gives them like at least someone who can handle the puck and also move. Mm-hmm. There's no real like dead minutes where it's like you're kind of looking through your fingers, worrying about whatever the third pair is. Like, they don't have that concern.
Canucks play the Flames on the Wednesday. Does Vancouver miss? Or sorry, they play the Coyotes on the Wednesday.
Mm. I don't think we need to preview that code. I think we're familiar with their work.
That seems appalling.
Mm-hmm.
They play the Flames the next week.
Right.
Do the Canucks miss Andre Kuzmenko?
No. No. Let's not romanticize. I mean, it's nice that he's scoring some cool goals and stuff, but I remember what it looked like towards the end here.
Scoring cool goals down the stretch for a non-playoff team.
Yeah.
That's Andre Kuzmenko's, that's like the sweet spot.
Yeah. Which is fine. I know that sounds like an insult.
No, but it's not.
I think there's like there's value in that.
I think if a team could find him at the right level and put him right next to like an elite player, kind of like what we saw with Pettersson and Kuzmenko,
right?
Especially if their system's a little bit less rigid than Vancouver's, I think it could work. I just don't think it was ever going to work here.
Yeah,
do you agree?
He seems destined to be an awesome Florida Panther.
Oh man, maybe that makes sense. Yeah. At like $1 million,
yeah,
on his next deal. Yeah, I could see it. I could see that for sure. Okay. We're going to draft stuff.
Yes.
And here's what we're going
to sandwiches?
I wish. We're going to draft types of Stanley Cup teams. So I'm going to go first to like illustrate the concept.
Oh, okay.
And then you can have two picks.
You should take like the best possible team.
Yeah, pretty much. That's okay. Well, to illustrate the concept.
And is your example going to be the 2022 Colorado Avalanche?
Well, I think yes, but I think you get multiple teams when you select a variety, right? And there's going to be some crossover.
Okay.
So I want to pick the front runner team that is great all season and then comes into the playoffs and is actually just like, yeah, oh, right. Yeah, that's the best team and they won. So I think in this, I'd get the 2022 Colorado Avalanche for sure. The 2017 Pittsburgh Penguins. I think both of the latter two Chicago Blackhawks teams qualify. The Detroit Red Wings. Like, yeah, this is a pretty common variety. In fact, the most common variety of Stanley Cup champion.
Right.
So the team that comes in is pretty clearly the best or second best team in the league all year and then actually takes care of business come playoff time.
I like
That's
it.
My pick.
All right. I'm going to go with the team that finally sheds its demons and gets over the hump.
I like those.
I'm going to go 2018 Washington Capitals.
Yep.
And people forget how close, like, they were down 2-0 to Columbus in round one in that postseason.
Yep.
Philip Grubauer was starting for them. They switch back to Braden Holtby, win a bunch of overtime games, finally get over the hump. I'm going to include the 2020 Lightning here, even though
they absolutely deserve to be.
Because think about how, after they got swept by Columbus, how we talked about them, right? It was like, this team keeps choking in the postseason. They just can't get it done. And then they finally just like definitively put their foot down.
They lost in game 7 of the conference final to the eventual Stanley Cup champion 3 times
yeah.
in the decade prior to breaking through. And they lost in the 2016 Stanley Cup final to the Chicago Blackhawks. Like,
But they should have beaten the year before or whatever, the Capitals won.
They should have beaten the Penguins.
Yeah. Yeah, they should.
They should have beaten the Bruins.
Yeah.
Honestly, like,
yeah.
They were right there. The only team that...
You mean the game where the officials decided they weren't going to influence the game by calling no penalties, which distinctly favored one of the teams?
Despite the fact that the Tampa Bay Lightning were 29% over the course of the playoffs?
Yeah.
And don't,
I'm sure that was an accident.
Let's not forget, too, that Gregory Campbell's dad had not yet recused himself from overseeing discipline in the series.
I didn't know we were stepping into conspiracy corner here.
He did it come the Stanley Cup final, but he didn't do it in that... he hadn't done it by then.
I like that.
It's a bad look.
Okay. Yeah, I think so that those are the teams that I think would like most qualify. I'm not going to include like that Penguins team that lost
the year
before to Detroit. Even though that was getting over the hump, that team was so young in terms of like Crosby and Malkin that it was too early for that.
I think you could include the 2019 Blues.
You could. We're going to use them for a different category.
We definitely are, but that's okay. We're going to use lots of these teams.
There's
going to
be overlap, sure.
Because I want to pick one. I want to pick the...
Actually...
Oh, sorry, you have two picks.
Well, also, I think last year's Vegas Golden Knights qualify in the getting over the hump, right?
Because
they were also a playoff choker.
They were in the conference... They had been in the Stanley Cup final in, 2018?
Yeah.
And then they were in
the conference... But then they lost to the Habs. They lost to the Stars. Both series, they were
both
pretty heavily
finals,
favored in.
Yeah.
And then obviously the
honestly,
Sharks one.
Honestly, you could probably take the 2022 Colorado Avalanche too, given their second round issues.
True.
Repeatedly. So again, these categories apply to lots of teams.
All right.
You could pick again.
Here's a fun one. The LTIR champions.
That is a fun one.
Give me the 2021 Lightning.
Yep.
Is that the 2015 Hawks?
The 2015 Hawks.
Patrick
yep.
Kane started this?
Yep.
Give me the 2024 Vegas Golden Knights.
Let's go. I like that. That's a good one. That's a very good one. I want to pick the team coming off something embarrassing the year prior.
Mm.
Okay. So for this, I'm taking the 2011 Boston Bruins because people will forget. It happened a lot
yep.
since. Like it's happened several times since the reverse
sweep. The reverse
sweep.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the time that Danny Briere broke the hearts of the 2010 Boston Bruins.
Yep.
We hadn't seen it in my lifetime. Like we hadn't seen it since like the 40s. You know, in 3-0 had been a death knell, sayonara, see you later, until the Philadelphia Flyers was it the second round?
Yep.
Or the conference final? Conference final, yeah, because the Philadelphia Flyers played the Blackhawks yes. in the Stanley Cup final, yep. and Chris Pronger was stealing pucks and stuff. Anyway, they came back and charged past the Bruins, so the Bruins had been reverse swept out of the conference final the year prior, and then they come back and they win the Stanley Cup the next year. Obviously, the 2020 Tampa Bay Lightning
mm-hmm.
are in this tier as well, having been swept in the first round following a historic season. They come back playoff ready. I like the team that has just sustained a massive, massive gut punch and then comes back, storms through, and wins.
Nice. We have one more, right?
I do, yeah. Okay. I'm going to pick the coaching change unlocks a team's offense. Now, nice. This is a weird one because it's always the offense that gets unlocked.
Mm-hmm.
And the two obvious ones here are the 2016 Pittsburgh Penguins and the 2009 Pittsburgh Penguins.
What about the 2012 LA Kings when they hired Daryl Sutter? Not to necessarily unlock the offense, but
that's true.
That was a coaching change team.
You're right. The 2012 LA Kings who... The problem is I see them as my next category, so I don't want to spend
Well, you're out
much.
Of picks. You're out of picks.
Oh, am I? We're done.
And I have one more pick.
I only made one there, didn't I? Oh, I made two.
No, you've made three, and I've made two so far.
Okay, well, whatever. Anyway. Bylsma, Mike Sullivan unlocked the Penguins offense, and they stormed through and won this cup. Okay, you go. Last one.
I'll take the dominant 5-on-5 team.
Nice. That's a good one.
The 2012 Kings. Honestly, the 2019 St. Louis Blues,
mm.
who were not getting goaltending, made the coaching change, but had sparkling 5-on-5 metrics the entire time, and that gets kind of swept under the rug.
It does. It does. They'd also been an elite team for several years. I like it. I like it a lot, my good friend. Thank you for doing this and pinch hitting for Jamie, and thank you to all of you. Jamie and I will be back next week. You're listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.